A founder and member of the Confessing Church, Bonhoeffer was instrumental in organizing Christian resistance and calling the German church to action. You need to know the story of this man and why our guest today, Eric Metaxas, is such an important voice in this Kairos moment where we're almost past the Rubicon line. In 1936, authorities banned Bonhoeffer from teaching at the University of Berlin. In 1937, they shut down Bonhoeffer's Finkenwald Underground Seminary. In 1938, authorities announced that every German pastor had to swear loyalty to Hitler. In 1939, Bonhoeffer was given the opportunity to escape Nazi Germany and return to Union Theological Seminary in New York. He spent 2 weeks in New York and returned home stating, "I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of these times with my people." In April 1943, Bonhoeffer was arrested for helping smuggle 14 Jews out of Germany. He spent 18 months awaiting trial in Tegel Prison, writing and ministering to fellow prisoners. And on July 20th, 1944, the failed assassination attempt entitled Operation Valkyrie failed, and Bonhoeffer was charged for knowing about the plot. He was court-martialed without representation and sentenced to death. And the next day, on April 9th, 1944, Bonhoeffer was ordered to strip naked before being hanged. Hermann Fischer Holstrung, a Flossenbürg prison doctor, described Bonhoeffer's last moments. He said, "Through the half-open door, I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer still in his prison clothes, kneeling in fervent prayer to the Lord his God. The devotion and evident conviction of being heard that I saw in the prayer of this intensely captivating man moved me to the depths." Bonhoeffer's last words were, "This is the end. For me, the beginning of life." No one has covered the story and life and impact of Dietrich Bonhoeffer better than Eric Metaxas, who joins us today on the show to talk about Bonhoeffer, Christian Resistance, and his new book. Buckle up, you're in for a treat. I'm Seth Gruber, and this is Unaborted. Welcome to the show, Eric.
It's great to be here, and I have 10 minutes longer than I told you, so I look forward to talking to you. And I'm grateful, for your summing up Bonhoeffer in that way, because we are living in a Bonhoeffer moment in America right now. It sounds like a cliche. I really wish it weren't true.
Yeah.
But the parallels are so dramatic, and it's vital that people with ears to hear understand it.
Eric, I wish it weren't so as well. It reminds me of something Bonhoeffer said, Eric. The question for a responsible man to ask is not how he is to extricate himself heroically from the affair, but how the coming generation shall continue to live. And we have far too many Christians in the church today who would rather abdicate their duty to contend for righteousness in the public square than be willing to sacrifice for the liberties we've taken for granted and kick the can down the road for our posterity. But Eric, I read your book, and here it is. I read this at 20 years old. I just turned 31. I went to Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California, a total joke of a college that creates men without chests and teaches cheap grace. And it was a pivotal book in my formation as a thinker and now as a pro-life speaker. And now I've launched the White Rose Resistance, which I'm rebuilding for this generation against our silent but far more deadly Holocaust of abortion. And it was so instrumental. And when we chatted at Rob McCoy, my pastor's studio, when you came out to preach at Godspeak, I said, "Eric, I need to tell you something." Eberhard Bethke, summing up Christian resistance during the war, and I recited a line to you from memory that provided the basis for shaping my entire approach to the church on politics and the culture wars. And you had actually said, "I'd forgotten about that. That's so powerful." And then you signed my book, and it was incredible. But we are starting to repeat some of those same mistakes right now. And so you've written a new book called Letters to the American Church, and I feel like this is kind of your "We're almost past the Rubicon line, church" book, but I wanted you to share about that.
Well, thank you for everything you're saying. I just have to say that, you know, either we believe Jesus and we believe in him and have given him our whole lives, or we haven't. And I think that you look in history, you look at the story of the German church, and you realize most of the folks who said, "I'm a Christian," including many of the Christian leaders, didn't really, really, really believe it. And you see it by how people act. If Jesus really defeated death on the cross, and you know that, you don't fear death because you realize there's no such thing. He defeated it on the cross, and I know that, and I can live genuinely freely. I don't have to be careful of what I say. I have to worry about what God thinks of what I say.
Yeah.
But obviously, many of us in the American church, we've been so blessed that we've gotten spoiled, and we forget that we are no different than the German Christians who were alive in the 30s, who had choices to make, and many of them made the wrong choice. And so the story that I tell in Letter to the American Church, I shouldn't say the story, but the case I make is that we in the American church today are in exactly the same position that the German church was in the early 30s. It is chilling. It is exactly the same situation. And it was the silence of the church that led to Germany going to hell at the speed of light. It was the silence of the church that led to the Holocaust and to all that followed. If the church had done its job to speak the truth in love, heroically and bravely, because they really believe in the Lord, if they had done that, none of that would have happened. But the case that I make in the book, and unfortunately, which I believe to be true, is that this is exactly where the church is today. We are being silent today, and our silence today is leading us dramatically and swiftly in the same direction that Germany went in the 1930s. Of the American church that is destroying America. The silence of the church is destroying America. And I thought, if I write about it in this book, some people with ears to hear will hear what God is trying to say to them. And I say, this is the voice of Bonhoeffer speaking prophetically to us now. Yeah. His voice was not heard by the German church.
Yeah.
And we see what happened. Yeah. The question is, will the American church hear his voice now and understand that we have an opportunity? We're already going in the wrong direction. So this is not an issue of, hey, this could happen. It is happening now. We are being silent now. Innumerable pastors are being quiet on the very issues that God is asking them to speak up on. They are being silent because they think it's the safe path, and it's the path to hell. It's absolutely frightening to me what the American church is willing to be silent about.
Yeah. Eric, you just reminded me of something Chesterton once said. Unless a man becomes the enemy of an evil, he will not even become its slave, but rather its champion, which is about as perfect of a Chestertonian translation to Bonhoeffer's phrase, silence in the face of evil is itself evil. Not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act. God will not hold us guiltless. I think Chesterton is saying there's no such thing as moral neutrality. And if you stand in the middle of the road, you'll be run over by a truck and you will become an advocate of the very evil that inwardly, Eric, inwardly you oppose, which is why Bethke's perfect encapsulation of Bonhoeffer's philosophy was we now realized that we were resisting by way of confession, but we were not confessing by way of resistance. And that the only way we were proving our resistance to the culture of death, which was slaughtering Jews, was through words, just like the church today proves its resistance to the abortion holocaust of our day through words. We're pro-life, Eric. We give the local pregnancy center director 5 minutes to share about our ministry once a year.
Yeah, maybe.
And then we check our pro-life checkbox. And so, once again, Bonhoeffer once said, Eric, if I sit next to a madman as he drives a car into a group of innocent bystanders, I can't, as a Christian, simply wait for the catastrophe, then comfort the wounded and bury the dead. I must try to wrestle the steering wheel out of the hands of the driver. The Rob McCoy version of this would be to say, the church has been waiting downstream to pick up human heartache that they helped create through their refusal to contend upstream for the godly politics where the ideas begin.
Well, it's another reason for me to love Rob McCoy. I mean, I want to tell you that we are living through this right now. I mean, it's an amazing thing. But first of all, why would we think we wouldn't live through this? Why do we think we get a pass that the American church can, everything can be fine and whatever?
We're too special.
Price has to be paid. We have to sacrifice. We have to live out our faith. And this is, to me, the key. And I write about this in the in this new book, Letter to the American Church, which is the shortest book I've ever written. But I write about the idea that, I almost titled the book, instead of Letter to the American Church, I almost titled it Faith Without Works is Dead. Mm. If you think that your faith is just some intellectual thing, what you say you believe, the devil is not frightened of what you claim to believe. He's frightened of people living out their actual faith. And by the way, God is not fooled by what you say you believe. He calls you to live what you say you believe. And if you do not live it out, and this is the chilling thing, Seth, is that people say, I'm saved by faith. Well, if your faith is proved by works and you have no works, it's just all intellectual and you're shrinking from engagement, from paying any price, whatever, God sees that you actually have no faith. You claim to have faith, but it's cheap faith in the same way that cheap grace is what Bonhoeffer writes about. It's no grace at all. It's no faith at all. Therefore, you're not saved. Let's think about that. Let's think about people in the evangelical church who say, like, I'm saved by faith. But what if God says, you have no faith? By my standards and my word, what you have is a fig leaf, and I'm not fooled by a fig leaf. I know that you're naked. Blood has to be shed to cover your nakedness. And you think you can fool me by saying I believe this or I believe that. You are not living it out. And the fact of the matter is that the church in America is 100% guilty on this issue. And we are in free fall as a nation directly because of the silence of the American church. And that's why I wrote this book, to say, folks, first of all, we need to understand this. We need to see exactly how do we get persuaded that silence was the right path? What lies have we bought into? What misunderstanding do we have of faith, of evangelism, of truth, whatever, that we have allowed this to happen where we've been silenced on issues of politics? Because do you think that Germans in Germany thought that they were serving the devil? I mean, a lot of these Christians in Germany who were silent, they thought they were doing the right thing. They had bad theology. They had been persuaded. Oh, Romans 13. They didn't understand that.
One of Hitler's favorite chapters.
It's not that simple. What?
One of Hitler's favorite chapters. Romans 13,
well,
church.
Obviously. So, but I thought to myself that there are many in the American church today, they've been persuaded that silence is the better path. Be nice. Don't be too heroic. Just be nice. And I honestly think that that's the voice of the devil. There is no neutral ground.
Yep.
Just as you said, quoting Chesterton. In fact, in the book, there's a chapter where I talk about the parable of the talents. Mm. And it's a chilling parable. What Jesus says is so chilling.
Yeah.
He's basically saying, like, okay, that guy gets 2 talents, that guy gets 5 talents. They risk it. And then their master says, great job, here's more. But to the guy who buried his talent, the master doesn't say, hey, you can do better. He basically condemns him. He basically says, taking this, what you thought was the safe path, is spitting in my face.
Yeah.
And God says, if you take the safe path, if you're afraid to live out your faith heroically, you have no faith. You can't fool me. There's no middle ground.
Yep.
There's no safe path. You're spitting in my face while you're pretending to do the religious thing and the right thing, in the same way that Adam and Eve thought, hey, we'll just use these fig leaves to go, we're fine. Everything's fine. And God says, not only is everything not fine, you offend me that you dared to think that you could cover up this problem on your own and I was not going to notice, or I was going to be okay with that.
Yeah.
That's effectively where we are when we say, I have faith, and I would have stood up in Bonhoeffer's day. I would have stood up in Wilberforce's day. But God says, but you're not standing up now. You don't have the guts to go to a school board meeting and say what you think, what the Bible says about sexuality.
Yep.
Or you don't have the guts to tell your neighbors that you voted for Donald Trump because you believe in the unborn are human beings, and that you think that you're crippled from saying anything for all kinds of reasons. And God doesn't say to us, we have to be perfect, but you've got to try. You've got to live out your faith boldly. Yep. And if you want to play the safe religious card, God will condemn you. That's what's so chilling to me. That's the parable on the talents. There's a chapter in the book on that because I never quite saw it so clearly.
Well, and Eric, what's the punishment for the guy who buried his talent and did nothing? How does that passage end?
Well,
he will be thrown out into utter darkness.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing thing. Like, it's the same thing where when you think about it, when Jesus is asked, you know, hey, what's the greatest commandment? You know, he's like, hey, tell me, Jesus, what's the great? And imagine what Jesus says. He says, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and mind and soul and strength. And you think, God commands us to love him passionately, not to just obey him or just to say, oh, I believe he exists or I believe what his word says is true. To love him, to passionately live our lives in worship of him, in obedience to him, with fearlessly to love him. And I think to myself, many churches haven't gotten that memo. They think that's too dramatic, or they're defining love romantically. They're defining love. They don't understand that self-sacrificial love to give your life for someone. And God is asking his church today, all of these people who are confused about their sexuality, about their gender, people in the ghetto who've been persuaded that the Marxist, Democrat, socialists are going to help them. You need to love those people by speaking the truth. And when you, who are my church, will speak the truth on those issues, you will bless those people whom I love, and you will be doing what I called you to do. When you are silent, you reveal your lack of faith. And I really think that this is an issue that we have to face right now. Your faith is not what you say you believe. Your faith is, people can see your faith by how you live your life.
Yep.
And if you're not living your life as though you know he defeated death on the cross and you're not afraid of anything except what he thinks, then you reveal your faithlessness. So it's an amazing moment we're living through.
Yeah, that's good. That's so good, Eric. I also think of the end of Revelation where it talks about people who will be thrown into the lake of fire. And it starts with the cowards. And you think, you know, Russell Moore comes up, you know, and Ed Stetzer and Rick Warren and Tim Keller, and they go, Jesus, that's not very winsome. You should have started with the pornographers and the sex traffickers. It's like, no, wow, the cowards. Wow, that's something. And then you go back to the parable of talents. What's that really talking about? Stewardship and responsibility. That's what that's talking about, which is why Bonhoeffer would say political action means taking on responsibility. This cannot happen without power. Power is to serve responsibility. And that's an idea that just, I mean, causes, you know, Russell Moore to urinate in his pants. This idea that Christians should accrue political power to wield effectively for God's purposes in the public square. And yet, no, that's actually the norm of God's
Well, I mean,
people.
If you think about it, I have a friend named Keith Junta, dear friend, who writes a blog at winepatch.com or .org, I don't know, but it's winepatch. And he pointed something out, and this has been in the back of my mind, but he articulated it finally for me. He says, Romans 13, when you think about who are the governing authorities, in the United States of America, we, the people, are the governing authorities. We've been deputized, whether you like it or not. You have been given the ability to govern yourself.
Yep.
And when you bow to you know, the Marxist regime or whoever it is, you are disobeying Romans 13.
Yeah.
It is Biden that is disobeying Romans 13 when he tells we the people you're a bunch of, you know, red-hatted bigots. So there's tremendous irony, but it's Winepatch is the blog. And I was amazed when I said it crystallized what I have been trying to say is that we are not in the first century in Rome. In America, we have been given this amazing gift of liberty and the responsibility of self-government. And if I do not wield that with responsibility and with the courage that God wants me to have, I am abdicating the very role that I'm supposed to have in this culture. So when people say you're not supposed to be political, I think to myself, that's exactly backwards. I'm supposed to take my faith into the public square. I'm supposed to live out my faith to bless others, not to create a theocracy, to bless other people, to give them freedom.
Yeah.
So,
Aristotle said, you know, politics is just the art of the possible. And in America, we the people get to determine what's possible, and that's a wonderful thing. But Eric, you just caused me to think of something that I hadn't intended to ask you, but because Tim Keller wrote the foreword or intro to your book, of course, many years ago, before we saw him for what I think he really is, I wanted to bring this up. This is interesting, connected to what you just said about we're responsible because we the people are the sovereign. And this also plays into something I call soft bigotry. When I use that term, I'm talking about the pro-lifers who say they're pro-life, but then they vote for the very people who lynched their neighbors in the womb. But then they tell us, oh, I would have been an abolitionist. Oh, man, me and Harriet Tubman, we would have been BFFs.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery. And so Tim Keller has this piece, Eric, from a few years ago in the New York Times called How Do Christians Fit Into a Two-Party System? They don't. And in typical Keller status, he starts with something inarguable that all Christians would agree with, and then he takes it to a heinous conclusion. It kind of describes Keller's career, in my opinion. Anyways, and in this article, he says, regarding the Christians who were apolitical and neutral during slavery in America, he says, because that's what we today would call getting political. He takes shots at apathetic, middle-of-the-road, apolitical Christians who allowed slavery, and he said that apolitical nature was, quote, supporting the social status quo. So he appeals to what you just said, Eric, that in America we have more responsibility because we bear more power as the sovereign political figure. And so therefore, Christians who just were, I'm neither Republican nor Democrat during slavery, were supporting slavery. But then Tim Keller writes on Facebook right before the election, right before Jack Gibbs had you out for the incredible sermon, What Would Bonhoeffer Do Today? And he had me out as well. He wrote on Facebook, he said, when it comes to voting, taking political positions, and determining alliances, the Christian has liberty of conscience.
Oh, it's listen.
So I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
In the book that we're talking about now, Letter to the American Church, I actually talk about Tim Keller, and I quote an article that was written in First Things magazine. Listen, this is tough stuff because these are people that I like, that I love. They're getting some stuff wrong. Now, Tim Keller, the key is that what he has always been saying has always been right until things changed. And then he continued to say the same things. So what worked in 1995, which kind of made sense, if the Democratic Party is not led by Marxist fascists, well, then you know, you can have neighbors that are Democrats, and you can. But when it's been taken over by people who hate the founders' view, you have no choice but to deal with the new reality.
Yep.
Tim Keller has not dealt with the new reality. So what he said, it was always beautiful and true while that America was America, but America has changed very radically, and to conveniently stick to that old line, it's heartbreaking for me, but it's why I deal with him briefly in the book, I hope graciously, because you know what? There are people I believe, you know, you mentioned Rick Warren and others. I hope, Seth, that in writing this book, I might reach some of those folks. In other words, I'm not taking pot shots at them. I'm saying, listen, let's reason together.
Yeah.
Where am I getting this wrong? Mm-hmm. If I'm wrong, I want to know. But I really think that it's very convenient to ignore some of this stuff, and they're ignoring it. They don't want to be enmeshed in controversy. I mean, in fact, I say there's a chapter in the book called 12,000 Pastors, and I talk about Germany in the early 30s.
Yes.
You had 3,000 pastors that stood firm with Bonhoeffer. On the other end of the spectrum, you had 3,000 that were very pro-Nazi. But in the middle, this is the key, you had 12,000 pastors who said, you know what? I'm going to be quiet. I'm just going to quote unquote preach the gospel. I'm going to keep my nose clean. I'm going to let those hotheads fight it out because I want to be standing when this is all over. I'm going to see which way the wind blows. I'm going to be quiet. God points his finger of judgment at those 12,000 pastors, I think more harshly than at the 3,000 who sided with Hitler, because wow. those 12,000 pastors had the power to change everything. Yep. If they had stood with the 3,000 like Bonhoeffer, it would have been another day. But they said, we're going to wait this one out. Hmm. We don't want to be divisive. We don't want to be political. Romans 13. Yep. I believe that is the chilling parallel to today. Hmm. And I wrote this book for those 12,000 pastors, that some of them would understand, wow. I got this wrong. I got sucked along. And before God, I do not want to continue. I believe that, I hope folks will give the book to their pastors and say, would you do me a favor and read this? Because I really think we couldn't be at a more crucial moment. You know yeah. that. Some of the people listening know it. I'm trying to speak to reason with yeah. those people and yeah. to say, do you have any idea how you've gotten these bad concepts, these theological, yeah. do you understand that you've been sucked along? The German church was sucked along exactly this way. Yeah. They didn't wake up until it was too late. Will you wake up before it's too late? And you have 10 minutes.
Yep. Yep. You're causing me to remember a story at Westmont College, my alma mater, where I started the first pro-life club, and my alma mater that hires pro-abortion professors, Eric, hires them. And I could tell you their names because I had emailed debates with these professors, right? And my alma mater's motto is Christ preeminent in all things. And so I would always joke with the intellectual, academic, Deutsch Christens-like professors there by saying, was Christ preeminent from the moment he was human? The moment of conception? Oh, right. So therefore every other child would be. And so you're hiring professors that are actually committing a Christological heresy by being pro-choice, which would maintain that Christ was at some point fully God, but not fully human. I digress. I once asked a pastor at Westmont, Eric, while I was a student there, I sat and I held dead baby photo signs on the campus and exposed their complicity. And Christianity Today did a very stupid, unfair article on me and all that stuff. But I asked a pastor there, I said, hey, why aren't you guys contending with this stuff? Or why aren't you contending against the federal laws that was trying to coerce Christian colleges to include like coverage for abortifacient contraceptives and all these other things. And he literally told me, well, Seth, there's different strategies. There's the strategy of the people who go head on and they file the lawsuits, Colorado Christian University, Liberty University, things like this, Hillsdale. And then there's those who kind of watch and observe and strategize on how to best engage. And you cause me to remember that thing. Oh, you're just talking about abdication. You're just talking about cowardice. So I'm rebuilding right now the White Rose Resistance, the story of Hans and Sophie Scholl and Christoph Probst and Alexander Schmorell, who actually had a meeting with Bonhoeffer on February 18th, 1943, in the afternoon that they never made because they were arrested at the University of Munich for their White Rose Resistance anti-Nazi leaflet campaign. So we're telling this whole story. Turning Point Faith and Charlie are sponsoring the tour. I was just at my pastor, Rob McCoy's church. We'll be at Jack's in November and churches all around the country. And what I'm doing in this, Eric, is I'm telling the story of the ideas that have woven their way through the American Republic with Thomas Malthus, Neo-Malthusianism, Madison Grant, Eugen Fischer, and Margaret Sanger, her influencers, Havelock Ellis, basically all the pontiffs of progressivism, how these ideas were watered in the American soil, the bad fruit that they blossomed because the church wasn't there being like a Chesterton and weeding out those bad ideas and contending upstream for these rights, how we got here and why we need Christian resistance today. But one of the points I make and that the White Rose Resistance focused on was to sometimes appeal to man's pride by saying, hey, even if your heart's not personally burdened by the Jew or by the unborn, hey, it should be. You need to pray that God burdens your heart for that. But hey, even if it's not, the rights and liberties you abandon today will be the rights and liberties your grandchildren never knew existed. Those who murder the unborn cannot be trusted to govern the born. And Martin Niemöller, first they came for the socialists, trade unionists. I didn't speak up. Then they came for me. Same idea. It's repeating itself now on the issue of abortion because abortion is our Holocaust. And those who will slaughter children in the womb, guess what? They don't have a problem lying and they don't have a problem demonizing their political opponents. And which is why we're now being called domestic terrorists and the greatest threat to democracy.
It's amazing. Truth is funny in that way, isn't it? It's absolutely amazing. Even the concept of duty, when you think about it, that idea has fallen by the wayside. Do your duty. Do the right thing, not because of how it might affect you in the next hour or in the next year, but because it's the right thing and you have an eternal perspective. Many pagans have a better idea of duty than so-called Christians. And wow. So I really think we're at a moment in the church, in a sense, where we're being called to live out our faith. We've drifted along with the idea that it can be an intellectual thing. Well, the Word of God says no, that faith without works is dead, and that if you do not live out your faith, in fact, you have no faith, and in fact, you are not saved. That should be a chilling thing for people to think about, that if you're not living heroically in a way that shows you know Jesus defeated death on the cross, then maybe you have no faith. Maybe you're going to hell because you have no faith. By your own definition, you are not saved. I say this because I believe there are people who will hear this, Seth, and I know that the Lord wants to reach them because he loves them. And so I do hope that my book finds its way into the hands of people who aren't where we are right now, who are a little troubled by this or a little troubled by that. And I would just say, well, listen, let's reason together because it's very important.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric. Hey, let's close out with this. The White Rose Resistance published in one of their leaflets these two sentences or one sentence, and it's today I would call this sort of the spell of the Johnson Amendment or the veil of the Johnson Amendment, and how we've allowed the other side to define the terms of engagement by labeling any genocidal to tyrannical assault on the Imago Dei and freedom as just politics and just follow the science to keep those politically impotent pastors silent. One day that veil is going to be pulled from our eyes, Eric, and our children and grandchildren will curse our names if we stood by and did nothing on, not to mention the 65 million murdered children through abortion in America, but every other victim of bad ideas. And they said this, they said, who among us has any conception of the dimensions of shame that will befall us and our children when one day the veil has fallen from our eyes, and the most horrible of crimes, crimes that infinitely outdistance every human measure, reach the light of day. And as you know, Eric, all of the members of the White Rose Resistance, except for one of the professors, they were all in their 20s. And they spoke with a level of moral and spiritual clarity that transcended most of the pulpits. In Germany, Bonhoeffer once said that only those who cry out for the Jews may sing Gregorian chant. And it reminds me of Isaiah 1, where God tells the Israelites, I'm tired of your singing, your songs, your religious festivals and activity, because your hands are full of blood. And so I wanted to thank you, Eric, for just being a son of Issachar and Ezekiel Watchman. Any final words for the book and this Kairos
it's
moment?
It's just what you just said, the Bonhoeffer quote, that's in this book, Letter to the American Church, because in a way, it sums up everything. The idea that Bonhoeffer said, you know, you go into your churches and you do this thing, but you will not speak out for the Jews. You're a fraud. You can't fool God. You're not fooling the devil. You need to get right with God. If you do not understand that your faith requires you to speak for those who have no voice, for the church to be the conscience of the state, if you don't get that, you are useless to God. God died for you to be free, to be his church in this generation. And Bonhoeffer summed it up in that. I quote him and write about that in the book, because it's exactly where many in the American church are today. And I believe the Lord is trying to reach people. I mean, again, it's why I wrote the book, just to say, I know there are people, they've been drifting along. They have some sense maybe that something's wrong. I want to reach those people. I want them to wake up so that we can avert the horror that befell the German church and the German nation. We are going down that path, but by God's grace, we can avert that. But if we don't wake up, that's the path we've chosen, and that's where we're going. So it's a chilling moment, but we do our best by God's grace.
Yeah, I might put it like this. We're done trying to wake up the sheep. It's time to start waking up the other sleeping lions. And I think that's what your book is aimed at and will accomplish. Eric, thank you, brother. Keep up the good work. And hey, we'll see you at our Love Life Washington conference on October 1st outside of Seattle.
I will be there. I will be at Rob McCoy's church. I'm everywhere. If people just go to my website, ericmetaxas.com, I'm speaking around the country. And I thank you, Seth. God bless you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you, brother. See you soon. Thank you guys for joining the show today. Head on over to iTunes, Spotify, YouTube. Give the show a rating and review. We will put a link to Eric's new book And you're not going to want to miss his message on lessons from Bonhoeffer and Wilberforce and letters to the American Church from our Love Life Washington conference on October 1st. If you want to join the White Rose resistance that I'm rebuilding for this generation against our silent but far more deadly holocaust of abortion, go to thewhiterose.life, thewhiterose.life, and you can go to thewhiterose.life/events to see our national White Rose Resistance live tour sponsored and promoted by Turning Point Faith that we're taking all around the country. We'll be at Jack Hibbs, Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills on November 6th, as well as churches all across the country. And if you want to become an ally of the White Rose to help us stop this genocide while it's still possible, you can join at thewhiterose.life to help us rebuild the army of resistance that Hans and Sophie dreamed of but never saw envisioned. Thanks so much for tuning in. Until next week, I'm Seth Gruber, and this is Unaborted.